Welcome to this episode of Galactic Chat. This is Helen Stubbs interviewing Ken MacLeod, multi-award-winning Scottish science fiction author of 14 novels, 2 collections, and many short stories. Ken, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you, Helen. Thanks for having me on.
A pleasure. Your most recent release is Descent, which came out in March 2014, and I'll ask you about that at the end of the interview. However, recently I read Intrusion, published in 2012, and I loved it. Would you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah. Intrusion was my attempt, in a way, to write what I called a democratic dystopia.
Right.
I wanted to write... I'll actually tell you the origin of the book, because it is kind of interesting in respect of how science fiction writers come up with ideas, at least how I do,
right,
if you like.
Yes, I'd love that.
Which is that I was down in London at a conference, an annual conference called Battle of Ideas, and I was on a panel called Frankenstein's Daughters about the possibility of improving the outcomes of pregnancy through artificial means. And we had some very serious people on the panel, an IVF doctor and so on.
A very interesting area, I think.
Yeah. And afterwards, I was in a Belgian pub in London with my editor, and we were talking about my next book. And my then editor, Darren Nash, sort of took me out, poured me some fancy Trappist beers, and we kind of brainstormed things and went through various ideas, and they all got rapidly shot down. And then I said, how about if there was some very simple way of making sure that every baby was born without any genetic problems at all, of correcting genetic anomalies? It was really simple. And there's a woman who's pregnant and doesn't want to take it. And Darren immediately pounced and said, you've got to write that. And I thought, what have I done? Because it seemed such a reactionary idea, you know, connecting with anti-vaccination and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought about it and thought about it. And me being me, particularly with, you know, some of my earlier novels, my initial version of the idea was something like some kind of international geopolitical conspiracy involving this and viral weaponry and so on. And no, this would not work at all. And my agent suggested I go and read The Children of Men. And
I've seen the movie. Is it similar to the movie, the book?
It's similar. The plot is similar to the movie. The movie, I think, takes it... I think the movie actually improves on the book for a change.
Interesting.
Yeah, in that it's a more vividly realized future.
Yeah.
But anyway, the idea of focusing down on the mother and the child was what she suggested. And I was talking to her on the phone, standing outside the place where I worked at that time, which was the Genomics Forum in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
That is a tiny part of a sociology network.
That's
which
where you were writer in residence?
I was there for about a year and a half. And
What? When was this?
2009 to 2010.
Right.
Yeah. And I was talking to my agent about it, and I saw a woman who worked in one of the adjacent offices just standing at the door going in, and I said to my agent, it's all right, I've seen the woman. I've seen the mother, because I suddenly had a vivid mental image of this woman as the...
And so she was your character? Did you...
Yeah, well, she gave the physical shape and the actual style and so on, about hairstyle and clothes and so on.
Do you have a photographic memory? Could you hold that in your mind, or did you try and snap a photo?
Oh no, I have a fairly good memory, visual memory. Yeah, I wouldn't say it's photographic, but I can.
Hold your character in your mind.
Yeah, Yeah, yeah. She became the template for my character. And I don't think I ever bumped into her again, so I've never been able to thank her.
Might weird her out a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a thought. In any case, now that I had this image in my head of Hope Morrison, and I got the story going from that. And basically, that's a setup. It's a not too distant future. There is this essentially magic bullet piece of biotechnology, which doesn't make improvements in the human genome or alterations. It just corrects any genetic errors in the developing fetus. And there are no major religious objections to it or anything, no human embryos or whatever are harmed in the making of it. And so it's quite acceptable.
Scientifically, would that be quite a far reach? Not really something that would be possible in the near future? Or
I really don't know. I mean, some genetic errors can be corrected by a very basic piece of molecular technology, if you like. So
right.
The correction of a genetic error can be done. But yes, this is probably not technologically feasible within the time frame that I imagined it. However,
that's
okay. Yes. I don't think it's a problem that we will be pressing anytime soon.
Yeah.
And the issues really in the story were that the pressures that come on this woman who's already had a healthy child without using the fix, as it's called, to have it.
Now, you mentioned several other creative professionals there, your editor and agent providing input to your creative process. Does that always work that way for you?
Sometimes it does. I mean, my first novel, The Star Fraction, came out of me and many years of previous thinking about it, and far, far too many years of writing it. Yeah. And the second one was a sequel. I had a 2-book contract for an unidentified second science fiction novel after The Star Fraction, and I decided to write a sequel, and I had the idea, which actually was after it was racking my brains to think of a sequel to The Star Fraction, which is a novel that ends pretty definitively.
Right.
It suddenly occurred to me that one of the minor characters in that novel, who is an old guy in the 2040s, would be about the same age as me, and therefore would have the same memories of the 1970s, for example, as I have. So I plundered my student diaries and notebooks and so on for local colour from Glasgow in the 1970s and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the subsequent books, and later on, as time went on, you know, you have discussions with editors particularly because they want a particular kind of book. And after writing Intrusion, for example, they very definitely wanted a book that had had a similar kind of feel, in that it was near future. It was about ordinary people, and there was some kind of major social issue at the heart of it.
I think it makes it very relatable because they are such ordinary people. So I saw in the novel that some of the costs of the society were the loss of choice and diversity. Do you think those losses are inevitable in the future? Or are they already going?
Well, in a way, they are already going, but they're going in quite subtle ways. To go back to my conversation with my editor, one of the things that he said to me before I actually came up with the idea, when we were sitting there in the pub and sort of brainstorming things, so he said, basically, we just want you to write the next 1984 or Fahrenheit 451 or Brave New World.
Yeah.
And I felt like saying, is that all you wanted, you know? And it did occur to me that all of these, apart from Brave New World in a sense, kind of are about the emergence of some new ideology or new political frame of reference or whatever. In Brave New World, it's Fordism. In 1984, it's the totalitarian ideologies. And I thought it would be interesting to write a dystopia. And my idea of a dystopia, the rule of writing a dystopia, or the formula for writing a dystopia, is that an oppressive system takes on a brave individual and wins.
Right.
Which is why it necessarily had to have a somewhat downbeat conclusion, albeit an ambiguous one. The thing was that there are a lot of, in fact, there are an increasing number of restrictions on everyday life. The state does intrude into more and more aspects of everyday life.
Yeah.
And it does it in ways that are ostensibly for our own good. And that runs counter to John Stuart Mill's dictum on liberty, that liberty should only be constrained for the protection of others, not for the protection of the person themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That to coerce someone for their own good is a violation of liberty. And this is a doctrine that came out of, you know, the system of law in Britain, largely from England, and many, many centuries of evolving traditions and ideas. So it's fairly basic to the entire English-speaking world, and it's gradually being eroded. So I just wanted to imagine something like the present situation, or the situation at the time that I was writing the last Labour government, where you just take these set of ideas and assumptions about protecting people for their own good, and you just turn screws just a little bit tighter, and then you can get a fairly oppressive society without anybody necessarily wanting it. And in the story, as usual in a dystopia, you have to have someone, a spokesperson for the oppressive system, kind of like the figure of O'Brien in 1984 or Mustafa Mond in Brave New World, explaining the rationale of the system.
Yeah.
And we have the MP who, yeah, when Hope goes to see her MP, to her about the free and social market, in which the government helps you to make the choices that you would have made,
yes,
if you had full information. Yes.
Yeah.
That actually sounds and was intended to sound not too far from the sort of things that mainstream politicians are all too willing to say and believe nowadays.
It's a bit patronising, isn't it? These are the choices, sure, that you need to make. And
yeah.
We're helping you. Apart from the fix not existing yet, what do you see as the key differences between vaccination and the fix? And did you have any concerns about how the book would be interpreted regarding vaccination?
Yes, I did. And some people have taken it as anti-vaccination. Now, I am deeply, bitterly, vehemently opposed to anti-vaccination, the anti-vaccination position. And in the book, there is a distinction made, because the reason why some of the other parents are so annoyed with Hope, the character, is not that she is endangering their children, but that she's endangering their modus vivendi with the authorities of having the conscientious objection to the fix. In the case of anti-vaccination, well, first of all, the arguments for it are really dodgy pseudoscience. Terrible, terrible stuff. And on the other, it genuinely does endanger other children. So anti-vaccination celebrities are responsible for things like measles outbreaks and outbreaks of serious childhood illnesses. I don't I don't agree with that at all. I mean, despite the kind of hard libertarian position I take on some things, I do think there are some kind of rather basic bits of social solidarity that we should all
abide
stick
by
with. Yeah. And vaccination, when it's proven to work, I think taking a small risk for the benefit of yourself and for the benefit of others is, a reasonable trade-off to expect.
Now, the second site and Fairyland are referenced in Intrusion. Do you have any theories or experiences of these phenomena?
No, I don't. But in a funny way, I come from the Highlands. Well, actually, I was born on one of the islands of Scotland, the Isle of Lewis. And my parents came, my father was from Skye and my mother from Lough Carron on the west coast of Scotland.
Now, that's where the story of Intrusion ends up, isn't it?
On the Isle of Lewis. In fact, where I grew up in the Highlands, a lot of people did believe in something like the second sight. And one of my aunts certainly believed that she had it. She became aware of, events happening far away. And
within this reality or within a different
In this reality, things happening to relatives and so on, deaths in the family, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the curious thing is that although people were very religious, I don't think they really saw it as what you might call a spiritual gift or something like that. I think they saw it as a natural faculty that some people had and others didn't.
Yeah.
Now, I don't... I haven't given the matter any deep study, and I don't profess to believe in it or to dismiss it.
Yeah.
I'm a rationalist and materialist myself, but, strange things happen.
Yeah.
The idea in the book, quite frankly, it came to me out of nowhere as I was writing, I think it was the first or the second chapter, in which Hope's husband Hugh is walking into the house, and this blue-painted barbarian walks across the corridor in front of him.
Yeah.
And this event happened, in my writing of the story. It just came out of... It was as much of a surprise to me as it was to you, as it were. And I thought, well, hey, that's something. And in the story, some of the characters come up with some kind of bogus physics rationale for what Hugh is and others like him experience, but it's never really explained in the book. And I thought that having this left ambiguous and or at least left completely unexplained does add something to the book. Some readers have said it detracted from it, from its its realism as a near future social novel.
I guess it is a sort of fantasy element that's thrown into an otherwise science fiction sort of reality sort of feel, but I think that works.
Good.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so we've talked about how your idea developed. Could you tell us a bit about your novel writing process? Are you a planner or a...
Gosh, yes, I do have a plan. Every time I have a plan, and at least ever since my first novel, which I wrote, I essentially made up as I went along, and it had to go through several drafts as a consequence.
How many years did you spend working on your first novel?
Well, I started writing it in 1987. And I think I started writing it by handwriting. The background to that was that my long-standing friend, the late Ian Banks, who was a friend of mine from high school, he had begun his own career as a writer. He'd always been very determined to be a writer when he grew up. Mm. And we were both interested in writing, and I occasionally wrote short stories and so on. And I used to tell him about the ideas I had for novels. And at the party after the launch of, I think, his second or his third novel, a mutual friend told me that Ian was getting really fed up of hearing about the novels I was going to write. And it was about time I wrote one. So partly to prove to myself and partly to prove to Ian that I could actually write a novel, I started writing this novel called The Star Fraction. Yeah. And various ideas in it I'd been kicking around in my head for years and years and years. And I had no idea where it was going. I just had the initial situation. And I went on from there. The description I once gave of that process was rather like the game of civilization. Oh, sorry, that's my...
That's okay.
The game of civilization, which Sid Meier's game, Civilization. Yeah. Where you start off as a little savage with a spear standing on a square, and as he takes steps through his world, it gradually fills in around him. And that's kind of how the world in The Star Fraction came about. It gradually filled in as the characters moved through it. And obviously when I had to write my second novel, not over several years, but over 18 months, while I was holding down a full-time job as a programmer, I might add, yeah. I knew perfectly well that this was not going to do. So I had to work something out. And ever since then, I have worked something out, but... Yeah. What the trap I have always fallen into is that really every time it's like I'm like one of these cartoon characters that keeps making the same mistake, you know, like,
oh no,
you know the ones.
Yeah. What are you banging your head against, or what's the same?
Well, the same mistake is that I work out a plan. I think I've got it all worked out and nailed down, and I'm. At a certain point in my working out of the plan, I become so excited about the story that I start writing it, and I'm certain that this time I can do it, and I take a good run at it, and I write it. I write 10,000 words or 12,000 words and slam into a brick wall. Look because there's something, some plot point, some major plot point or whatever that I haven't actually figured out. Right. And so I have tried to do better than that. You know, with my next contract, which I have just signed.
Oh, congratulations. It's
thank you. It's for three novels to be written over 2 years.
What are you doing talking to me? You should be working on those.
Exactly.
Well, you must be a fast writer these days.
Not as fast as I'm quite
getting
a fast
faster
writer.
All the time, perhaps.
Not really. If you look at the dates of my books, they used to be one every year, and now they're down to about one every 2 years, which is disgraceful, and that's what I intend to repair over the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And the basic reason is that problem that I mentioned, in that I of starting writing without having it all properly figured out. Yeah. When I'm actually writing, I can write. When I know where I'm going, I can write quite fast. So one of my pieces of basic advice to writers, and at the moment I'm in a position of giving basic advice to writers because I'm currently the writer in residence on the MA Creative Writing course at Edinburgh Napier University.
Yeah.
And we have more than a dozen students every year. And I think there's 16 on the course this year. And they get a very intensive course over 1 year, 1 year full-time or 2 years part-time. And one of the pieces of advice that I give and wish that I took more myself is that when you're writing, you want to be writing. You don't want to be staring miserably at a blank screen trying to figure your way out of a plot hole. Because writing time is precious.
That's
if
true.
You can if you can, when you're actually writing, putting words on paper or on a screen, you want to be focused on doing just that and not on solving some problem that you should have solved months earlier.
Okay, so you like to really know where you're going when you sit down to write.
Yeah, certainly for a novel. A short story, quite often you can hold a short story in your head. You can have a developing situation and run with it.
Yeah. So do you actually go into planning chapters and scenes and in that degree of detail, planning that all out ahead before you begin to write?
I do plan down to the chapter level. I think I need to plan down a bit further than that. I know that I asked Ian Banks about it, and as you know, Ian Banks wrote quite long novels.
And lots of them.
And lots of them.
Yeah.
And he said, he casually told me that he had it planned down before he started writing it, all down more or less to the level of paragraphs. Every incident. And he had every incident in the book. But Ian had a quite extraordinary mind. When we were a lot younger, when we were both students, he once came round to my house while I was trimming the hedge and then helping with some carpentry work in the house.
Yeah.
And he, over about 3 hours, he told me the entire story of one of his space operas that he had just thought of or just worked out. He told me the entire story of his Against a Dark Background.
That's amazing. It was all just in there, ready to be disgorged.
Ready to roll onto the typewriter. Yeah, so he would sit down, sort of for 2 or 3 months. And just write basically every day. That's what I aim for, but it's not always what I achieve.
Well, I'm very sorry for your loss of Ian.
Must
miss him.
I do a lot, yes.
So you've told us how you got into writing. Ian was sick of hearing about the stories that you weren't writing that you could have made. Do you still love writing? What have the highlights been for you?
I do still love writing, and I'm well aware both that it's kind of a privileged way of making a living, and I've had many other, I've done many other
worst
jobs.
Yeah.
I've certainly done much worse jobs, and I've done jobs that I enjoyed but weren't as fulfilling as writing is. I mean, it's a tremendous creative satisfaction. And I think that is the main thing I love about writing, is being able to create something and create a character or world or whatever, and see what are inchoate ideas and feelings and so on turned into something that hopefully looks quite solid. So you're sort of producing the product with your imagination and then finding that other people enjoy it. That's really worthwhile.
I perceive your work as being both literature and genre fiction. Are there any difficulties in residing in both categories? And if so, how do you deal with them?
I think the answer is yes, there are difficulties. The main difficulty, I think, is that quite a lot of people, including reviewers and literary critics and so on, tend not to see any genre fiction, and particularly not science fiction, as legitimate literature. And that galls me sometimes.
Yeah, I find it devastating.
I can well understand why literary authors who write science fiction will flat out deny that they're writing science fiction. Mm. At one time, Margaret Atwood famously said that what she wrote was, I forget what it was speculative fiction or whatever it was, but as science fiction was talking squids in outer space. And I was quite chuffed by that, because actually me and Stephen Baxter, the English science fiction author Stephen Baxter, are, as far as I know, the only writers who have written about talking squids in outer space.
You are the science fiction authors.
Yeah. I'm 50% of what Margaret Atwood doesn't write.
I love her Handmaid's Tale and Oryx and Craig. I mean, they're great stories too.
Yeah.
And not all that different from 1984 Brave New World, I would say, but...
I think, 1984 and Brave New World are taken seriously as literature.
Yeah, true.
But in a way that not many science fiction novels are. And I think part of the problem is that science fiction, if you describe it kind of theoretically, and somebody who's a perfectly respectable literary author can write it as one kind of fiction. But science fiction also exists as a genre, and which I'm very much part of. And the genre involves a kind of ongoing interaction and conversation between writers and between texts across decades sometimes. And for a very long time, it was only available in highly unrespectable magazines with garish pictures on the covers.
Mm-hmm.
And so science fiction tends to get associated with its most disreputable, or at least superficially disreputable, aspect.
Mm-hmm.
There are also kind of deeper aspects of that are problematic in science fiction. I think it took quite a long time for genre science fiction to rise to the kind of level of writing competence that was available in other forms of pulp fiction, like, for example, crime stories and detective stories, let alone rise to the level of literary fiction. And I think it has made that kind of progress. But quite deep down, there is a fundamental kind of feel about science fiction, which I think puts off a lot of people who have, you know, quite mainstream tastes, because the mainstream novel, the literary novel, is about character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's centrally about character and relationships and so on. And in science fiction, no matter how much you put into the characters, and, you know, the characters come alive certainly for the writer and hopefully for the reader, the real focus of interest is not on the relationship of human beings with each other, but of human beings with external nature, with, you know, non-human nature, even if that non-human nature is our own physical bodies or whatever. It's about something other than human relationships. And naturally, what that means is that science fiction tends to attract a lot of people who are not very good at handling human relationships or are not very interested in them. And socially awkward nerds and geeks and so on. Of which I am, very much one. Certainly, I certainly found when I was a teenager, I found that science fiction was a tremendous relief from the problems of struggling with relationships with my family and with other kids at school and that kind of thing. It was this blessed relief from the constant yammering of my own hormones and of my own people I lived with and so on.
I agree. Yes, but I think it's wonderful and totally legitimate to escape into an alternate reality or a slightly different reality. It's quite a respectable way, actually, of finding an outlet. So, but that's a very interesting distinction that you make between literature and genre fiction or science fiction. Now, will you tell me about your latest novel, Descent?
Yeah. Well, my joke about Descent is that it's about flying saucers, hidden races, and Antonio Gramsci's theory of passive revolution. as experienced by a middle in the, through the context of middle class family life in a near future Scotland. So it's very nearly mainstream literature. It's the central social topic, if you like, of dissent, the one that's at, in some respects, at the core of it, is the ongoing or still unresolved economic crisis that began in 2008. And I'm kind of projecting that into a not too distant future, maybe 10. I'm a little bit vague about how far in the future it is. And at the opening of the actual, the chronological opening of the story, the young protagonist Ryan and his best pal Callum are out walking in the hills above Greenock, where again, with my usual lack of imagination, is another town in which I grew up and which I know pretty well.
Well, I think you should write what you know, so I guess.
Write what you know, that's right, yeah. So quite a lot of dissent draws on things that I know, apart from the flying saucers, of course. Now, there aren't really any flying saucers in them, but what happens is that these two young lads are walking along, grumbling about the state of the world they're in and so on. There are blockades on the road below and burning tires. Imagine Britain going into a situation kind of like Greece was a year or two ago, totally bogged down. And they're grumbling about that. And as they're walking on the hill, they get knocked down by a strange light from the sky. And their different takes on that event begin to affect their lives for the rest of their lives up until the implicit present of the story in various ways. And they live through some historical interesting times, but from the point of view of the narrator and main character Ryan, all of this is kind of in the background to the various dramas of his own personal life, where again there is an issue of kind of around the ideas of pregnancy and fertility, which is not a theme I intend to pursue much further, but it becomes a serious issue in the story.
Interesting. Great. I look forward to reading it.
I hope you enjoy it. When I was writing Infrusion, I had a mental slogan for what I was doing, which was I was writing the Genomics Aga Saga. You know what an Aga Saga is?
I don't know what an Aga Saga is.
Aga Saga. It might be a British term. An Aga Saga is one of these stories of middle-class family life, usually from a woman's point of view. The most famous exponent of it, who actually does it brilliantly, is Joanna Trollope. And I wanted to write something like that, a story of family life with this genomics problem in the background. And my similar mental marching orders for Descent was that it was bloke lit. That's the kind of male equivalent of chick lit. It's
yep.
It's stories like Nick Hornby's High Fidelity, or you know, like that, about
exploring the male experience.
Yeah, about usually being a complete klutz at dealing with personal relationships and gradually learning better, having some sense beaten into them by a good woman usually.
It sounds great. And what are you working on now?
Well,
your three novels.
Yeah, well, as a bit of a departure from these kind of novels, which, if I can just talk briefly about the way in which my writing has varied over the past 14 or 15 years since 1995, when The Star Fraction came out. I started off writing fairly near future novels that were exploring various political and social ideas, which by the time I'd written the fourth one, The Sky Road, I had kind of exhausted my interest in the topic for the moment, and I started writing space operas. And I wrote, first of all, a trilogy, then a couple of standalone space operas.
Yeah.
And by the time I'd written these five space operas, essentially, I had worked up another charge, if you like, of indignation at the world.
Yes.
And returned to near-future thriller-type novels. And so I wrote The Execution Channel, which was about the war on terror, The Night Sessions, which is a police procedural set in a future Edinburgh, and which is revolves around religion and secularism. The Restoration Game, which is set in the present. It was set in the present of as I was writing the book in 2008, and that's kind of about the post-Soviet world and its roots in the Soviet world. And then Intrusion and Descent. And what I'm doing now, what I've got my publishers really excited about, my plan to do now,
yeah,
is writing three closely linked novels in fairly rapid succession, which are far future. And to put it very schematically, they're about a robot revolt from the point of view of the robots in outer space.
Interesting.
So, well, I hope so.
Yeah.
it's taking off again from the
Can I ask you, how human are these robots? And I mean, do they have strengths and flaws and characters? And
well, to sort of elaborate on it, many of them aren't really what we'd think of as robots. They are, or the viewpoint characters in the story are essentially uploaded human minds that are controlling robot bodies, and that have a virtual reality in which they can take time off and live in something approximating to them a human life. That's
right.
Yeah,
that's the plan.
Yes.
All right, well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thanks very much, Helen.
No worries, Ken.